Everyone has a copy of Senator Ferguson's report. All in favor of the passage of the amendment? Opposed? Amendment carries.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more amendment I'd like Mike Scott to come up and talk to the committee on.
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming up, and I think that the purpose, if I understand, I want to make sure, if and I'm not following this, because the understanding is that you're trying to make this bill balance, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
He's taking out money out of this, out of things to make it balance.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Scott. I'm an aide to Senator Ferguson. Senator Sturgiluski alluded to a problem with the Taktovik runway. It was in the latest work draft that came out of Senator Dankworth's office, but is not included in Senator Sturgiluski's work draft that is now before the committee. Last year, the legislature appropriated $2.5 million for a runway in Taktovik, which is in North Slope Borough. The borough, since that time, has run into land use problems, and at this point tell us that they will not be able to construct the runway, and it's their advice that we go ahead and reappropriate it. So we have some language here that would reinsert Taktovik back into 643, the working draft you have before you now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgeon.
Senator Ferguson. Mr. Hogan is here, or was here, and had indicated
the
of a contract between the administration and I guess the borough in this case. And I think that the issue is, you know, it's not on the issue of the change in that's a separate issue from the legal one. In other words, we need to be sure that we have an appropriate document releasing, if you will, whatever those contractual arrangements are, and that's the only issue that's raised in that. And perhaps Mr. Hogan has other comments to make on that, having heard Mr. Scott's comments.
On that, Senator, through the chair, it's our understanding from the Department of Administration that would simply require a contract amendment to the existing one they have with the borough.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that before this bill is passed that release is made, or at least contingent upon that in some kind of wording. I think we need to be technically accurate in the bill, and that's the purpose, of course, of the amendments that I've made.
Contingent wording. Can you make that
amendment
contingent on the release of the contract? Mr. Chairman, I'd so move the amendment contingent on removal of the contract.
Mr. Hogan, for you.
Mr. Chairman, we have one language change requested by Senator Kelly. Brought up this time, in which version it was. He would add a sentence.
Will you come and take a seat here, Jay? I can't hear you over there. Maybe you better get on.
Better I just pass
this on. All right. Changes here.
It would make an appropriation contingent upon this act.
Yes.
Okay.
Senator, have to make a motion.
Right. It's already, it's already there.
Okay.
It's already not there.
Well, that change is made.
I just want to make sure.
Well, let's verify.
I don't
want to
make a motion.
Could we verify it with Mr. Hogan so we're absolutely sure? Yeah, I understand.
Where did Jay go? Oh, there.
Jay, what you?
Yes.
Have a chair and relax and explain to us what this amendment is.
Mr. Chairman, this would be 130 in Max's original draft, and it's 131 in Senator Sturgiluski's. He would just add a sentence, the second sentence in 131, making the appropriation contingent upon the South Fork area forming a fire service district. He would request that that district be formed before the grant be paid to the municipality for the South Fork Volunteer Fire Department.
That's 130 in
yes, 131.
131 or 130?
In the original draft, it was 130, in this draft.
We're not working off of that. The Sturgeolinski.
It's 130 also.
Okay, 130.
Okay, 130, excuse me.
Senator Kelly's not here, is he?
No, sir.
I mean, did he ask you to present his amendment for him?
His staff person brought it up, and at that time, we knew there were three possible drafts, and we couldn't tell her where it would end up. I said that I would.
Senator Sturgeolinski, you may be familiar with this. He wants us, does that amendment force the city of Anchorage to form a fire district to get that money?
Mr. Chairman, that's apparently the intent is to make that contingency.
Well, I'm not going to support that.
Mr. Chairman, since we'll be having this bill before us for the hydro on Monday, it seems like that might be appropriate to request Senator Kelly to come and explain it.
But we hold this amendment until Kelly can come. Senator Dankworth?
Well, a little strategy plan here in discussing the bill. Senator Sturgeolinski, you said that you would like, and I had prepared to break this hydro out of the bill, but it does create this problem, and that I have to put it on a Senate bill, and it's so important. And quite frankly, some of the erratic actions at times next door, I worry about putting on a Senate bill and losing it. The hydro stuff is important. I don't know, and I think we searched for a House bill to see if there was a House bill that we could attach it to. There is one other way, and that's, of course, to put the hydro on the budget. But if you wanted it separated out of here, we could do that. Shall we talk about that between now and Monday? We don't have to make that motion today. I wanted you aware that I don't know of a vehicle here. That if we put a Senate bill out of here today, I'm afraid you might be able to kiss it goodbye.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to request certainly the leadership needs to take a look at this whole issue, and I would appreciate if that were held. And I think that personally that we should separate the hydro from these others, and I would be very happy, but I won't bore you with the list of items that I consider as operating that are put in this, and I have some problems with the bill, and I think there's a chance that maybe somewhere along the line others might, and but it's up to the will of this body.
I understand. Okay. Let's see if we can find another way to pull a hydro out. But I think,
Chairman,
as long as we have Jay here, I'm still a little bit confused, which is not unusual, but I suspect most of us are in a bill of this magnitude. What concerns me, if in fact, and you've done some work in this bill, not a great deal, but some, you know generally what it's composed of. So I guess my question to you would be, how many dollars, roughly, is diverted from energy-related projects, hydro, whatever other deals with energy, into grants to or appropriations of capital improvement projects?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Elmer Lindstrom has the figures on the hydro, part of a memo that he prepared for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Eliason, it's difficult to say in the original version or even Senator Sturgeolinski's version of House Bill 643 what the exact amount that was taken from particularly Department of Commerce, Power Authority, and spread out in other areas. There is some loss, but there are energy projects in 643, say through the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. I would just guess that probably around $25 million, which is approximately the amount of the Susitna project, would be a rough guess of the amount that was at least not in the Department of Commerce for power projects.
Well,
We lost $25 million in this particular bill as it relates to power and energy.
Mr. Chairman, that'd be a very rough estimate.
Jay, how do we, what's the use of procedure in drafting a reallocation bill? How can we identify what we're really doing, where the money comes from, where it goes? But it certainly isn't the method you use, is it?
Mr. Chairman, the method we used last year was to put the adds and deletes within the same section of the bill. In other words, I've forgotten the number of the bill last year, but it might end up with three or four subsections in a section, A, B, C. A and B would knock money out, and C would reappropriate something, so that you, in essence, had them paired.
It all balanced out. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Is there any way in this short period of time we'd be able to come up with some type of a document which reflect these concerns that a lot of us have as it relates to this bill, where the money was, where it went to, and what potential programs we were cutting out and promoting into other areas? My concerns, especially with the energy programs, I think we have a commitment, and we've been told by a number of people today that our whole hydro program's in trouble for lack of money. If that's the case, I seem, you know, it's rather difficult for me to support something which takes $25 million out of that program when we are in desperate need of more money. It just doesn't seem to add up. But if we had some vehicle we could look at or some document to give us a rough idea where we are as it relates to reallocation, new projects, and energy, could that be possible?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the 608 essentially does this for the power projects. It's a little bit more difficult for the others because we're not really sure how they were all related. I suspect we could work with the staffs of the various people who helped put that together and try and arrive at something like that. But the power projects are obviously easier to do that with than the rest of the bill.
Need to lapse the contract.
Mr. Chairman, so on the other hand, I want to make sure that everybody realizes that if you had a power project in your district, particularly, and I'm going to speak to the rural projects now, the reallocation of the major programs, and I hope any of my statements understood what I was saying about isn't whether we put a few more bucks in. I'm putting $25 billion more in the TAI. I was addressing the long-range need. Putting a few bucks in there, I'm saying that we might ought to take some out, not put more in at this time. That's what I want to talk to Eric Yoel about, to find out should we put more money into Terra and into TAI and stuff until we find out where we're going. That was my question. But some of these, if you have a windmill, it's an energy deal. If you have a windmill study or a geothermal study or something in the rural Alaska, and they wanted to change that to something else, I've said this a number of times, you want to change a windmill to a grant, I think you may get your grant vetoed where you could have kept the windmill. But I don't think that... I think that's why I wanted to take 608 out, and that's why Senator Sturgeolisky wanted out. 608 pulls all that out and puts it aside so you can look at it.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's a sort of a policy question also. If, in fact, we are going to drop $25 to $40 million out of energy, it might be wise to lapse it back in the general fund and use it for increase our school foundation program or increase our dividends to communities.
Well,
that type of operation. I don't know. These are questions that should be addressed.
Well, you're going to drop it back into TAI. You take it out of TAI. Did you count the $25 million into TAI?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The $25 million for TAI is in both 643 and 608. The major difference, of course, is the Susitna, which is not in 643 and is in 608.
But it's in 608.
Right, correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Where was Susitna before 608?
So Susitna was on the, it was attached to, the House attached it to their budget, and the governor vetoed it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, back to Senator Lyson's central point. If we take out of 643 and put into 608 all of the hydro-related projects, 608, according to what Mr. Lindstrom has said, is going to be another $25 million out of balance. Is that correct, Mr. Lindstrom?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
All right. If we take out of 643 all of the power projects and put them into a separate bill, am I correct or not correct that 643 will be out of balance?
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
That would not be correct.
Well, I asked the question.
You're talking about hydro.
The power.
No, you're talking, right. If you're talking about energy, then it would be out of balance. But there weren't any hydro projects in the rural areas to begin with.
Yeah, I'll research this some more. I think what we're talking about is adding, I think,
yes.
608 would balance, but you may be about $25 million short in 643 if you try to do the TIE bid in 608. I noticed the TIE bid is in 608, which was a separate question, which the governor agreed to put on the ballot, or not on the ballot, but in the capital budget. So I didn't know it was going to be in 608. We've just taken $25 million and stuck that in 608, made it balance. Apparently, I think you're right, though, Senator Sturgis. I think it may be sharp. We'll have to go back and look.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lindstrom, did you understand my question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Because the Susitna was anticipated to be funded through the capital budget, I assume, and was not in 643, yet is in 608. Aside from Susitna, everything else that is in 608 was in 643. So therefore, if you took all of the items in 643 that are in 608, you would be out of balance in 643 by approximately the cost of the Susitna appropriation.
Yeah, what's happened? And so you make sure this is getting it's hard to keep up with, but the note here reminds me originally 643, $25.6 million was in there for Susitna. There was $25 million put on the House side, was later vetoed in the deal. What happened in 643, we just changed that to TIE and intended the $25 million to go back into the capital budget, the same one that the governor said that he would not veto. Again, he vetoed both the House and the Senate, including Susitna. But I see it's back in 608. You take the $25 million back out and put it back in the capital, and then you're going to be all right. It'll eventually balance.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I'm going to request from Legislative Finance that they do for me another draft that will reflect the changes that were made today and would take out the energy-related projects and reflect them in 608, and then I'd like a balance as to whether we're in balance or out of balance with 643, with the remainder.
Over.
Mr. Chairman, to clarify, you would only want out of 643 those items that are currently in 608, because as Senator Sackett pointed out, there are other energy appropriations, say through the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, that are not in 608. So just to understand, you would only want those items out that are in 608.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move for the record the CAFTO would run with the lapsing the funds contingent upon successful completion of amendment to the original contract between the state of Alaska and Norstover.
Question through the chair, Senator. I don't really think that does it. I wonder what we really want to say is that contract lapses. We don't, an amendment could be anything. What we really want to do is to say that we're not going to use it for that. Isn't that what we want to say?
It's whatever you want.
Well, no, I'm asking, isn't that the intent, that
well,
contract would be...
To me, we're going to take care of it one way or
okay.
the other.
Okay, and so, well, fine, if I won't argue the point, then if this, an
you
amendment could be anything.
Restate your motion, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we put in CAFCOVIC with the contingent upon successful completion of an amendment to the original contract between the state of Alaska and North Slope Borough.
All in favor of the motion? Carried. In view that the bill will be up before the committee again on Monday, is there anything that is germane that should be handled today and should not be handled on Monday? If not, First item this morning will be committee substitute for House Bill 156, actually relating to legislative contracting.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Augusta?
I could just make a couple of remarks to kind of bring us up to where we are on the bill. HB 156 originally dealt just with legislative contracts, and I brought that before the had been assigned that bill and brought that to you in March 3rd of this year, and there was a lot of discussion at that time, but at the time the committee said that they wanted to see if the legislature was to be covered, to have the administration covered. There was a bill over in, as put in by the governor, HB 546, that dealt with state contracts. And at that time, this bill seemed to be receiving a lot of work by Mr. Lawrenson from the AG's office and by the State Affairs Committee there. And it looked like that bill would move forward. It has been going back and forth, it seems, between committees in the House and has not. Since this is the governor's priority bill, and we've done work on the Senate side, there was a request that we take a look at both the administrative as well as the legislative contracts, and I advised you that I would do some work on it. We used HB 546 as a vehicle. I think that it had a lot of good work done on it and was, I think, a very good vehicle. One of the issues that has come up has been dealing with the process used for awarding of professional contracts to architects, engineers, and land surveyors, and we can talk about that. I think that's one of the reasons they were having some problems in the House side. We've handled it in this suggested bill by allowing for regulations to be set under the professional services contract. There are a couple of issues raised, and I'd like to call, if I could, my staff person, Glenn Svensson, and Mr. Lawrenson from the AG's office to come up on this. Questions have been raised about the court system being included and about the university system. The court system was included but is not now included because of the issue, the constitutional issue has been raised on that. We've talked to Mr. Snowden, and he had indicated this was an informal conversation, that he had no objection about being under the bill, but he says, in fact, their regulations are tighter than this bill. The present version you have before you does not include the court system. There's a question that has never been fully resolved, and that's about the University of Alaska. It is the opinion, I believe you'll hear, and you can check with Mr. Lawrenson, that the university is in fact covered under this bill as a state agency. And I think that's an issue, I personally feel they should be covered. I think that's an issue that may at some point be resolved in the courts. I think on the question of contracts, that this has caused more problems for the legislative, the number of audits done, the requests by both the public and the individual legislators. So I hope that, you know, that this bill might have an opportunity to pass this year. And with that, I wonder, I have given you the latest version of the bill, the fiscal notes that are attached, and a sectional analysis. And if it's appropriate, I'd like Mr. Lawrenson and Mr. Svensson to come up if there are specific questions. Just so to be sure we have this, the thing, this has had obviously a lot of versions. The sectional analysis should be from dated May 14th from Mr. Sokol, Legislative Counsel, to myself, dealing with the finance version. The draft you should have should read SOFO 51582, and there should be fiscal notes attached. The Department of Administration for $345, $1,000, the legislative affairs agency for $30,000, and then one from .puff showing a zero note on it.
What was the legislative affairs number?
$30,000.
What's that for?
That would be for the preparation of contracts, advertising, and so on. It adds a process where you are going through a process rather than much more of, you know, informal approach that's been used.
Mr. Chairman, where would that, is that legislative finance?
That's legislative affairs agency, their role in processing the contract. That it's a processing charge.
Well, they've been doing that for some time. Do they need additional people? I mean,
say additional people, but they're talking in terms of
advertising
and, you know, the request for proposals and so on that would be requested.
That they haven't been doing.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how you'd want to proceed to go through, you know, item by item or so on. I would say that right now the situation is that each of the departments have guidelines. The major ones are Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Transportation, Department of Administration. And there are no statutes, and in most cases, although Mr. Lawrenson could speak to this, there are not actually adopted regulations. So the guidelines in a lot of cases are, in a sense, reflected here, but they are not in any way, you know, standardized and really available in statute form. Mr. Lawrenson, is that a correct statement?
That's, yes, ma'am, it sure is. It's very accurate. But,
why don't we just start at section one and write.
Well, I would, I don't know, would you like Mr. Lawrenson to lead us? I don't know quite how you'd like to approach
either
it. Would you just read it, and if anybody has any questions?
Either yourself or whoever you designate.
Well, Mr. Lawrenson, do you want to just?
I'd be happy to go through it. The part that I'm least qualified to speak to are those portions that deal specifically with the legislature's professional services contract provisions in here. But they are, in most aspects, very parallel to what is being proposed to apply to executive branch agencies, including the University of Alaska. The first two provisions...
Mr. Chairman, if I could just one clarification. Did I state correctly the situation with the court system, that you felt there were constitutional problems, so you left that out?
There is a constitutional issue as to whether or not the legislature can impose administrative rules, these kinds of administrative rules, on the judicial branch. Initially, the court system was not included in the House version. House State Affairs did not include them, but when it got to House Judiciary at that point decided to include the court system. Court system wasn't aware of it at that time. When they learned about it, Mr. Snowden did contact me. We have given advice in the past that said that the provisions that now deal with competitive bidding under state for state purchasing do not apply to the court system, mainly because of the way they're drafted and because of their history. We did not address the constitutional issue. But there is a specific constitutional provision that gives to the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska the power to adopt administrative rules for the court, and it could very well be that provision, that particular part of the Constitution has never been interpreted. It could well be that that rule means that only they can prescribe administrative rules, and that only the legislature can change those rules once they've been prescribed, and then only by the required vote for change of a court rule. Since these would be new procedures newly adopted for the court system, it may be that they would be unconstitutional. We just don't know for sure.
Point is, they are not included, Mr. Chairman, because you specifically asked that question. I wanted you to know.
The first two sections of the bill on page one are simply designed to acknowledge that there is another procedure that may be used in letting contracts for various state kinds of projects. They are really just curative to make sure that it accurately reflects the fact that a new chapter 3698 is being established by this bill, and that 3698 is the chapter that deals with professional services contracts by executive branch agencies. Section 3 of the bill, which runs for the next few pages, establishes the procedure by which contracts of the legislative branch, professional services contracts by the legislative branch, would be let.
Mr. Chairman, on that, I would point out that those, Section 3, has been before you and does not, has not been changed. We can go over that. Section 4 of the bill deals with the ombudsman. There's a particular problem there with the investigative contracts, and we've spoken to that. That was also in the bill that was before you before.
The procedures set out in Section 3 for the legislature are, in most respects, very parallel to the procedures that would be adopted and applicable to the executive branch. And perhaps I should point out the two areas in which there is, at least appear to me at this point, to be a difference that you may or may not want to think about as we go through this bill. With respect to the legislative contracting provision, the threshold for application of these procedures is $10,000. With respect to the executive branch, the way that bill developed in the House, the figure was pegged at $25,000 and remains at $25,000 in this bill. From the governor's office point of view, the limit that the legislature establishes for itself is really, and we have no particular interest in offering to you what that figure should be. We just point out that the figure that we believe should be applicable to the executive branch and was developed in the House State Affairs was the $25,000 limit. At present, the Department of Administration has rules, and there's an ongoing controversy as to, there's an item of litigation going on as to what effect those rules have in terms of being binding on state agencies, that establishes a procedure fairly similar to the ones established here with a threshold of $20,000 as being the beginning limitation for kicking these rules in. House State Affairs felt that...
Do you have any of the knowledge or the logic as to why some arrive at 10 and some at 20 and the executive at 25? Is there any particular reason between that, or is this just numbers that appeal to people?
Between the 10 and the 25, I do not know the respective considerations for using 10 for the legislature and 25 opposed to 10 for the executive branch. I do know that the 25 was arrived at by saying, well, $20,000 has been the limit that the Department of Administration established a couple of years ago for all departments under its rules. And given inflation the feeling of the House State Affairs Committee was that a more realistic figure at this point was $25,000, and we have utilized that $25,000 in our testimony as being the appropriate limitation. We feel somewhere between 20 and 25 would be an appropriate limitation at this point. And I have no opinion, as I say, on what the legislative branch.
Mr. Chairman, we had discussion on that before, and I personally have no problem with the higher limit. We've had some people wanting it to be less, and I think that becomes a policy issue, and I've no problem with consistency on the issue. The legislature, I think, tends to have perhaps some smaller contracts, and it's whether you want to exceed down to make that process go through the, go through a process at less than that.
My only thoughts are consistency between branches.
I wanted to point that out so that you were aware of that difference. And as I say, we're not taking a position as to whether 10 should or should not apply to the legislature. The rest of the procedures essentially track the procedure set out for the executive branches. It requires that certain advertising take place when an agency intends to let a contract for professional services for the executive branch in excess of $25,000. Advertising must take place at least 30 days. The first advertising must be at least 30 days before the contract is to be awarded. There must be at least three separate advertisements let, with the next two coming no later than 3 days after the first one, or each one consecutively no later than 3 days after the one preceding it.
Mr. Chairman, where are you reading that? In this bill?
To a large extent, I'm talking off the top of my head. Because I'm trying to address the similarities between the executive and the...
When we deal with requests for proposals, is that what you were talking about? Or is it preparation and acceptance of proposals? But maybe I'm going to make sure I'm reading off the right bill because...
Okay.
I'm looking at page 2 under the committee. sure this is the right one. May 14th, 1982.
We don't have to.
The,
Mr. Chairman, it's very important to point out that, in fact, the legislative, because of our need to move quickly, does not contain that same provision, so, you know.
Because I've been so closely involved in working on the executive branch aspect of this, I now see the way that the legislature is set up. A 30-day advertisement requirement does not apply to legislative contracts. There is a 30-day advertisement requirement in the executive agency contracting portion of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, did we accept this in budget audit? Isn't that one of the things we accepted, this same language or something?
Well, it's the process we use, and it worked very fine, but we have the $10,000 threshold. We did not put in that 30-day because you've seen cases where we needed legal advice. Of course, that's sole source, that can be done, but you needed to expedite that, so it's less onerous than, frankly, the administrative in that case.
Well, and I don't mean to jump around, do you mind if I ask some questions now on this, because you're talking off of what the administration is doing. On page 2, when we talk about proposals from at least 6 firms shall be selected for contracts equal to or greater than $100,000, I assume that there's enough latitude there. If there's only 2 firms in the state that handle that type of a thing, that you would have to go outside to get the other 4, but or maybe you wouldn't be held to that 6.
Chairman, Mr. Svensson, can you specifically speak to that issue?
Mr. Chairman, in section 020 there, the procedure set up is that ideally the intent is to get 6 firms for larger contracts, 3 proposals for contracts below $100,000. A succeeding subsection provides that if there are not that many firms apparently qualified to do it, you can ask for proposals from anyone that had applied. So you can ask.
Where do you read that?
On page 3.
All right.
Line.
Okay. B says that you can. Source required service, a person or firm can clearly perform the required service, then you have to go before the legislative committee.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
And then it goes on to say, though, in number 2 pretty well nullifies that, or maybe it doesn't. It just says a member of the legislature has approved the exemption and a written justification why he didn't go to bid.
Right. I'm also
kind of address that, if you would, kind of how we. I remember how, well, there was a lot of discussion on it, and I couldn't remember how we finally got this language in.
Let me, if you will pardon me, Mr. Chairman, for jumping around as well. If we jump to page 7, the parallel provision in the executive branch, page 7, lines 12 on. It provides there that if the required number aren't available, then you can ask for proposals from whoever it was that appeared qualified, even if there are less than 6. And in this version, there are 2 sources. There is advertising and there is the register that administration would keep.
Mr. Chairman, in other words, Mr. Svensson, we would need to add then that wording to the legislative contract.
Yes, to clarify that.
To clarify the point, that was certainly the intent, but we could that could be done.
Okay. Well, did if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, make sure I understand it. If in awarding, let me get on page 2. I want to go back to request for proposal, and on page 3. I'm sorry, section B.
3B.
Yes, page 3, section B and C. I'm more interested in section C. And then it says the exemption in B of this section applies only if, and I'm particularly interested in number 2, a member of the legislature has approved the exemption and a written justification signed by that member of the legislature that details the reasons for the exemption. Does this basically say that if any legislature wants to take it upon himself to go ahead and exempt himself from these rules, he can do it as long as he files an affidavit under the law and why he exempted it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not, in response, it's not an affidavit, it's a written justification. There may, for instance, let's take a look at the railroad bill. You needed expert advice. You don't want to make it so tight that you're not able to go and get the information that you need. And it's merely to say, okay, what's the process used? And in other words, it's a light touch, I guess, if you would say, on the ability of the legislature to go ahead and carry out its duties and get the information that it needs. And it isn't an affidavit that you swear to. It's merely a statement of, you know, why you use that process. In a sense, it's protection to the individual legislator, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, it's in the case of a sole source contract,
that's sole source.
A committee, or if the contract is administered by an individual member, they are allowed to go sole source if they provide some reasoning. It just is it's not trying to cut out, you know, or overly restrict people, but yet have some public piece of information. They're saying why they went sole source rather than RFP.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Dankert, you raise a very good point on that amendment, though, that should be parallel wording with the on the where you have to get the RFPs and you don't have enough people out there to do it. That's easily taken care of.
What would be, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, what would be like on, and that I'm going to stick with that just for a moment, that section 2 dealing with the approved exemption. Up to what amount could a legislator sign an affidavit or fill out a form? Does that refer back to the $100,000?
Mr. Chairman, the $100,000 at the front is related to the department. Oh, okay. Excuse me. I'm getting the wrong $100,000. No, it's any of the contracts that would have required this procedure, that is those over $10,000 that would have required a particular procedure for sole source exemption or public need exemption, would be covered by the process.
Mr. Chairman, it would be over the $10,000 now. The administration, of course, has that $25,000 threshold, but obviously those dollars to contract would have been subject to legislative approval at some point. I mean, you just don't reach out and find that money. It would have gone through the, be included in the finance, legislative finance budget, or in legislative affairs for contracts, or a specific appropriation for a contract. So there's control by the legislature going in as to the amount of dollars available.
Well,
I
understand that. I you have to have the money before you can spend it. But if we appropriate, and I just to follow me for a moment, let's say that we appropriate to the Senate Finance $100,000 for miscellaneous studies or whatever we want to approve, and I want to do a $50,000 study on the Whittier access. I think that there's one or two people who have almost manage over all the other consulting firms because they did the original study. They've done, say I can justify it. In a sense, what I can really do though is, and I'm not objecting to it, I just want to make clear that I could go ahead and issue a $50,000 contract as long as I'm willing to show the committee why I went sole source.
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly my understanding.
Yeah, there's a slight difference in whether it's a contract where the money is earmarked for the committee project or earmarked for a member project, like through Ledge Council, usually. If it's a committee contract, the committee has to act on sole source. If it's a contract administered by an individual member, the process is just as
sure.
You described.
I don't object to the provision. I just want to make sure everybody understands that I can see quite a loophole in there. It's pretty broad. And I'm not objecting to the section, but somehow it seems like it kind of guts the up to a point.
It's more than exists now.
Yes,
the concern
I don't have any better language.
The concern was somehow making it workable and still flexible.
Mr. Chairman, were there other questions?
Senator Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know when it's appropriate now, but I'd move that we delete section 2 on page 3, mm-hmm. Knock out the sole source.
Where's section 2? Is that what I was reading?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, which one would that be?
Line 13, I believe, on page 3, if I'm looking at the right document.
Oh, the justification for, or...
No, he's talking, pardon me, Senator Ferguson, if you will, I think you were talking about line 13 on page 3. That's the section I was just discussing, isn't it, that little 2?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just point out for you that we do not have the bill before us at this time. I don't know if you want that moved or...
Why don't we move to take this up as the working document?
Mr. Chairman, I would so move that we, the Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 156 Finance, 515 draft, be considered a working document. Ask unanimous consent.
Favor? Carried. Back on page 3 now of the document, line 13.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we delete section 2, where it states that a member of the legislature has approved the exemption.
Mr. Chairman, let me object for the purpose of discussion here. I wanted to point that thing out, but I, like I said in my testimony, I don't have a better answer of wording. I don't really want that. Really locks us into a situation where the legislature would never be able to get any interim work done, I'm afraid. However, I think that that's been, you know, I think I don't want to overreact to an abuse that I think we've seen of these. If that amendment were to be adopted, can you give us your view of, you've researched this, what would that have the effect of doing?
Mr. Chairman, since the procedural requirements for advertising are much more flexible for the legislature, I'm trying to figure out what the, if you did not allow a contract administered by a member to go sole source, the advertising time or the time required to get proposals from a number of firms could be shortened up considerably. The procedures allow a flexibility of even being able to call up and ask several firms to submit something. I guess the part of the answer is how many contracts really would be under the administration of individual members as opposed to committees too during the interim. It probably would not, it just depends. If there's a small number of individual kinds of contracts, and with the more flexible advertising procedures, probably would not be an onerous burden.
I guess what I'm saying is, would this be the case, that if we take that section 2 out, that the legislature will never, no legislature can ever go out and contract without going to bid?
That is an individual contract administrator. That would be correct.
Well, he could use section 1, couldn't he?
If the committee, certainly. If the committee signs off.
He could go to the committee system and get an okay to do it, but if he didn't do it during the session when the committee was here, something comes up during the session, there's no way you're going to do it without going out to advertise.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand the effect of this amendment, right now, a legislative agency, legislative committee, or a member of the legislature can go through a contracting procedure. One would be the RFP proposal approach, and the other would be the sole source. And the one element that you've taken out would be the individual member's ability to go sole source. And is that correct? Statement of what that effect would have, but that an individual member could still go through the RFP process as could a committee or an agency. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's better to get some rules that govern us all, and then if we have abuses to that, we can always come back to amend it. I personally feel that there are times when that flexibility has certainly been desirable to individual members to get the information that they need, as long as the dollars are appropriated.
I wonder if, Mr. Chairman, I certainly don't object to Senator Ferguson moving his amendment, but if he had no objection, just to hold the amendment until we finish discussion this, that there may be other sections over here that will come to light. I need to think that one out a little bit. I hate to vote on it without giving it some thought.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw the amendment, but this amendment has the potential for abuse.
It does.
That's right.
Because you're not taking into consideration the minority members of the legislature who probably will not have the ability for sole source. And it should be the same for a majority member, minority member going to committee system.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a very good point, and it's a judgment call.
I didn't quite understand how the minority got into it. How, explain that again.
Well,
I don't believe that a minority member will ever be given sole source contract.
Oh, I see. All right. I wasn't following that memo.
Are there other specific questions, Senator Dankert, or can we go on with
where we are?
Where are we?
Well, I think with all that discussion behind us, we've really gotten to the middle of page three, the section that is called Preparation and Acceptance of Proposals. And that simply sets out the procedure, the kinds of considerations that are applicable to legislative agencies in developing their RFPs, their requests for proposals, and then in evaluating them after they have issued them and received responses to them. The next section at the bottom of the page, award of contract, simply sets out a procedure by which awarding these contracts is to take place. And in section A says if it's a contract by a legislative committee, it has to be authorized by a majority vote of the committee, which is probably the case, I would assume, right now. Section B is just another procedural provision that talks about who's going to approve the content and form of them, and says the executive director of the legislative affairs agency is to do that in conjunction with the legislative finance division and legislative legal counsel, where each of their respective areas of expertise are applicable. They will be involved in making sure the form and content of these contracts is acceptable.
But Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to note they will not be in the policy as to whether or not that's an appropriate subject to go for contract. It's the form
of the contract. C on line 7 on page 4 sets out some specific items which must be set out in the contract, the first being the amount of the contract on the first page, specify a date for work to begin, and specify a date for work to complete. Contract is to give a description of the kinds of services to be provided, and there's also to be a certification that there is money available in an appropriation for the purpose of the contract. These provisions parallel provisions established for the executive branch agencies, and I suspect were just drawn over here to provide for a similar treatment for legislative contracts. On line 15, we have a section titled Evaluation. It provides that project directors or the committee for whomever the contract was done are to do an evaluation of the contract after it is completed, and that evaluation is to be put on file and be available for public inspections. Then on page 4, line 20, we have a section called Filing, which sets out certain procedures or requirements for the filing of the contracts, of the request for proposals, and of the proposals that were submitted in response to the request, so that those are available and open for public inspection. I would point out here one difference between the legislative and the executive branch and the treatment of requests for proposals that are placed on, or proposals that are placed on file. Under the executive approach, the request for proposals is to be put on file, the successful proposal submitted is to be placed on file, and then the names of the other bidders, but who are not successful, is to be placed on file. This calls for each of the proposals, whether it was successful or not, to be placed on file. And that's, again, a policy call. I don't know from one point or another whether you want that much paper in a file or not. If you want the proposals of all the unsuccessful bidders in the file, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Sometimes proposers, one of the reasons that unsuccessful proposals were not included in the filing requirements for the executive agencies was that at least individual proposers take the point of view that those are their property, and that if they're not accepted, they may be disclosing trade secrets, they may be disclosing other processes or procedures that they don't want to have made a matter of public record if they're not to be the successful bidder. So it was retained that only only the name of the unsuccessful proposers would be put on file, but not their unsuccessful proposals. Here you've got the unsuccessful proposals filed. I don't know if it's worth the time that I've taken to talk about it or not, but that is a difference between the two.
Mr. Chairman, probably not, but Mr. Svensson, do you have any comment?
Mr. Chairman, at the same time, we have a couple of audit requests that have been submitted requesting that the audit division compare the proposals submitted with the one granted to see if there was some favoritism that exhibited that didn't reflect the adequacy of the proposal. So I guess it's a policy choice.
Continuing down page four, well, that really completes the discussion of filing. There is a special exception. I don't know, you want to talk about that special exception?
Mr. Chairman, I might point out on line 27, page four, there is an exception in the filing of proposals and requests for proposals for the audit division to allow them to file the material once the audit the subject audit is released to the public, so that they are not, before an audit becomes public, broadcasting what the audit will be about and what people will be trying to find and so on under a contract. That's purely a disclosure kind of thing. They would be required to file the same material, but once the audit has become public.
Then at the top of page five, we have a definition section that defines what professional services are for application of the provisions for legislative contracting, and that definition tracks the definition that's established for executive agency professional services contracting. The section four, starting at line nine on page five, provides that the ombudsman is to adopt similar provisions to these for his own contracting for professional services, and the ombudsman is to do that by regulation. And with that discussion, that closes out those aspects of the bill that deal specifically with legislative contracting. Section 5, that starts on line 15 of page 5, would establish a new Chapter 98 in Title 36 of the Alaska Statutes to establish a professional services contractors chapter for executive branch agencies, including the University of Alaska. And as I've already indicated in earlier discussion, the first section, application, establishes a threshold for application of this chapter at a $25,000 contract. It provides two other situations where this chapter will not apply. One is in a situation where it's really just a contract of employment of an individual to work on behalf of an agency rather than as an independent contractor. That's paragraph two. And paragraph three says this chapter doesn't apply if an agency goes out and uses the provisions of competitive bidding that are established in 3705-230. Otherwise, this chapter applies to professional services contracts. At the bottom of the page five, there's a section, Professional Services Contractors Register, calls for the Commissioner of Administration to establish a register for persons and firms who are interested in being considered for professional services contracts, and establishes a mechanism by which those persons can get themselves on that contractor's list, and a mechanism by which the Commissioner, from time to time, and the Commissioner is either the Commissioner of Administration or the Commissioner of Department of DOT. Commissioner DOT only for DOT contracts, the Commissioner of Administration for all other agency contracts. That's defined later on in the bill. That C on the top of page 6 at line 5 simply provides for the Commissioner to update that list from time to time. Then beginning on line 10, we've got the section that I began talking about, which provides that state executive agencies are to advertise their intent to a contract at least 30 days in advance of award of the contract. Provides for three separate publications of the intent to contract, with each of those coming no more than 3 days from the prior one. And then it provides that the toward the bottom of the page at line 18, the kinds of things that are to be included in the notice of the intent to contract.
Mr. Chairman, in regards to publication of the listing contracts, it says an example of general circulation. How about some of the areas that really do not have that circulation? You know, local listings, but they will. How would that be handled?
In terms of what this requires, it would be for an individual agency, if it believed that a particular contractor was in an area, would be more likely contacted by a local publication to use that local publication. This would not specifically require it. It's the kind of thing that the commissioner, under a separate section here calling for regulations, could establish as part of the regulations requirements.
If the work is to be performed in a certain area, is there a guarantee it will be advertised?
It really ought to be published in that area, that's right.
Is there any guarantees here, though?
There's no guarantee here right now, that's right.
Mr. Chairman, I think some wording to the effect modifying that general circulation in the state and or in the area where the work is to be performed would satisfy that.
I think that would cover that. Some of the, I've understood in the past that there have been advertising in large newspapers and place that would be in effect if they're not, you know, unaware of the ability to bid.
I think the intent is certainly not to prevent people in the area from knowing. I think that kind of clarifying language would.
Could you draft something like that?
Yeah, sure.
Subsection B, down at the bottom of page 6, starting on line 24, tells the agencies what they are supposed to do as the, in addition to the 30-day notice requirement, the publication requirement that's established in subsection A, and the additional things they are to do is to go through the professional services contractors register that was established in an earlier section of the bill. They are to send out requests for proposals to anyone who's on that register, to anyone who's specifically on that register, and they're also to send it out to anyone else who, well, no, that's as far as that provision goes. After they've reviewed the register, if they see the names of individuals who appear to be qualified for the work they want secured, in addition to newspaper notice, they are also to go out and actually send a request for proposal to those people who are on the contractor's list. Subsection C, at the top of page 7, line 5, establishes the same sort of threshold as was established for legislative contracts, where you've got a contract in excess of $100,000, you're supposed to go out and attempt to secure at least 6 proposers. Where the contract is for less than $100,000, you attempt to secure at least 3 proposers for the required services. And then it goes on to provide at line 12 through line 20 the language that talks about the situation, which we've already discussed, because of its not appearing in the legislative aspect, a situation where you just don't have enough proposers to fulfill that requirement. This tells you what you do if you don't. You still solicit from everyone who's on the professional services contractors list who appears to be qualified, and anyone else that you are aware of who appears to possess the necessary requirements. That's what 1 and 2 do it in
Mr.
the middle
Chairman,
of the page.
Let me find out where you're at.
I'm on page 7. I'm talking about the subsection that begins on line 5. I'm really talking about the portion of that subsection that begins on line 12, if the expertise required.
Yeah. Let me, I'm running out of lines over here.
Mr. Chairman, it's the one that begins, if the expertise is not available,
right.
And that would answer your question.
If the expertise required is not available to enable? Okay, and you're going to continue on down that page. I'm particularly interested down on in section 1 of D, but under little d.
Section 1 of D.
Section 1 under D.
Okay.
Under D.
On the page, that's page 7,
right.
Line 22.
Line 21, 22. D establishes those situations where the provisions of this section that call for 30-day notice and going to the contractor's register and going to 6 for more than 100,000, going to 3 for less than 100,000, would not apply. And there are essentially, well, the first one is essentially the sole source exception that was discussed with respect to legislative contracts as well. The contracting agency demonstrates there's a single source available for the work. 2 provides a situation. This is the top of page 8. The second exception would be where the commissioner, and that's either of administration or of DOT, makes a written determination that public necessity will not permit the delay. This, I think, is the way of dealing with a situation because there is a flat 30-day requirement. Otherwise, the situation where you really have to go out and get a contract entered and underway in less than the 30 days.
Mr. Chairman, what I want to point out is here is this is the loophole again, and there we have one in the legislature that the commissioner is doing that right now. That's what this whole state's upset about. They're, everything is almost sole source. There's so many things going out over there. They said, well, we don't have the time, so they're letting contracts go without going to bid. What we've said after all these pages is that the commissioner can decide whether to bid or not, and or any legislator can go ahead and put out his bid. As long as he'll fill out a piece of paper saying why he did it. Now that might be what we want to do, and there may be good justification for it, but to me, in all fairness, because I support this bill and I support strong legislation to have people go out on bid, I think in all fairness to it, those two big loopholes, we just set it back and said that the commissioner and the administration can decide what is sole source and what's not, and just justify it with a letter. I've been there, so I've had the experience of doing just that, so I know how that's being done every day. And I think that's what Senator Ferguson is concerned about. And we did it in the legislative session. And again, I'll have to admit that I don't have better language to propose, and I don't know, but this seems like when we leave a loophole that big, anybody, it really says that they don't have to go out to bid, doesn't it?
Well, I understand that, and I guess abuse and certainly the language makes it open to abuse. The thing that it does that I believe tightens it down is that it flatly, by statute, makes it the commissioner's responsibility to make the determination as to whether public necessity, and there's a definition of public necessity later in the bill. I mean, he's got standards that he's got to satisfy. It isn't just whether he feels like it's okay or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, isn't that there now?
No, there's nothing like that in the statutes right now.
There has always been a requirement that they go out on bid. They have some regulations that most of those things go out on bid, and usually they waive the bid. They call it, they call up in any agency that needs a snow machine in December, and they said, if we don't buy it right now, we won't need it in July. Well, so,
of course, when you're talking snow machines, you're not talking professional services contractors, but yet you are right. The Commissioner of Administration does have rules that may or may not be particularly binding on agencies, and some agencies consider them more binding than others do on themselves. But the way those rules work right now, as long as the commissioner of the individual agency comes to the Commissioner of Administration and says public necessity or sole source, the Commissioner of Administration just signs it off. This makes it clear that the certification of the individual commissioner of an individual agency is not adequate. The commissioner of the Department of Administration, except for DOT, has got to make that determination himself, and he's got to put his name on the line. He doesn't have to sign right now. So that is a difference. I realize that it still does open things up to potential abuse, but there are certainly, and I think everyone recognizes, valid situations where it is going to become necessary. And I think what we really need to aim for here is to come up with a statute that people will start living with and complying with, and then see what kinds of abuses arise. Right now, it's certainly wide open because it's only by rule of the commissioner of administration. This creates some additional, I believe at least, and certainly the governor's office believes, creates some additional tightening of the procedures that are in place, whether they're used or not right now, of course, is a matter of debate from agency to agency. I think we
understand that.
You've got to start somewhere.
You don't have to argue the bill with me because I support it. I understand what you're saying, but let's say that the Department of Administration now has to put his name on it. So what? Who goes back and checks, and who does he answer to?
Well, ultimately, he answers to you folks, to legislative audit.
Not really. I've never seen one. It never comes before the legislature, and that's why I'm saying if there was something in here that says every one of those things that went out to sole source had to be somehow published, reviewed, brought before the legislature or something, but all he does is just sign for him. There's nobody going to ever look to see who got the contract and who didn't, and he just signs for it.
If I might interject, in view it's 10 o'clock and the senators need to be on the floor, We'll come back at 2 o'clock this afternoon and continue. So we'll just recess the committee for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chairman?
Senator Stojanowski, we're back on the committee substitute for House Bill 156.
Correct. And just for the interest of the committee, I handed out two amendments. I know you wanted to wait till the bill was through to consider those, but the first was in response to a question raised by Senator Dankworth, and the second by Senator Eliason, and I don't know if they hit the mark or not, but you might want to look at those when we're finished. I believe, if you don't mind, we'll just go on with Mr. Lawrenson, and we were approximately on page 7, I believe.
We had been at the, thank you, Senator, we've been at the bottom of page 7, the top of page 8, talking about the situations where exceptions to the contracting notice requirements set out in this section, I believe it's 030, would apply to, or would be in effect. And those exceptions that we discussed already were the sole source and a public necessity. The third exception is on the top of page 8 at line 4 and talks about situations where the service to be acquired would be acquired from another state agency or a political subdivision or a federal agency. And that is parallel to an exception which is created with respect to legislative contracts as well. Subsection E on page 8 simply outlines the kinds of information that must be set out or made available in a request for proposals that is advertised under the requirements of this section. It must contain a description of the work, it must contain information necessary for prospective contractors to submit a response, and it must provide a description of factors that will be considered by agencies when they evaluate the proposals they've received. And you'll see further down, there's in another section, section 040, there is a requirement for agency evaluation of proposals based on allocation of points. And that section says that not only must points be established for the evaluation, but the same criteria must be applied to each of the proposals submitted. Subsection F is really a technical provision. This is in the middle of page 8. A technical provision designed to deal with a situation where at least some legislators in the House were concerned that these procedures might be interpreted as limiting agencies from going a further step, an additional step beyond what's required here in locating prospective bidders or proposers. So F was added to make it clear that agencies, in addition to this, could also do whatever else appeared to them to be appropriate to secure interested proposers in making proposals on contracts. And then at line 18, we have a section titled Award of Contract. That sets out the procedure once the proposals have been submitted for evaluating them, assigning points to them, and then carrying out the executing the contract, getting it signed, and put into effect. Subsection A there talks about having those proposals evaluated based on the assignment of points, point values, for various factors which the agency considers important in evaluating the proposal. And it says that all proposals received must be evaluated using the same factors as those set out in the request for proposal, and that ties back to the earlier language that I just described that says that the request for proposal has to detail the various factors for which points will be assigned. Subsection B is very procedural. It just says it's got to be executed by the contractor and the project director for the agency, and then says if contract is by a board or commission, it has to be executed on behalf of the board or execution has to be made on behalf of the Board or Commission and must be authorized by that Board or Commission. A lot of this is just very straightforward, but we're putting it into law to avoid any questions. Subsection C starts at the bottom of 8 and continues on to 9, and that simply provides that the Commissioner, and again, this is the definition of Commissioner either as Commissioner of Administration or Commissioner of DOT, must review and approve these contracts before they can take effect. And in fact, at the top of page 9, there is a requirement the state agencies make clear in their request for proposals to proposers that that the state would not be obligated to perform until such time as the approval of the commissioner had been obtained. Subsection D, on line 4, page 9, sets out the same kinds of criteria or elements which must be set out in a contract awarded under this chapter as the kinds of elements which I also described talking about legislative contracts. It's supposed to reflect the amount of the contract, the date the work is to begin, the date the work is to be completed, describe the kinds of work to be done, and a certification that there are funds available for in an appropriation for that contract. Subsection E on line 14 also goes on to discuss situations where a contract may have been entered which is in a non-standard form. Many of the state's professional services contracts right now are entered based on a standard form, but from time to time there are contracts which, for one reason or another, vary from the standard form, and this says that those have to be approved and reviewed as to form by the Department of Law. Then at the bottom of page 9, we have a new section 050, which talks about contract administration. It says the agency, the state agency which enters the contract, has the responsibility for the diligent administration of the contract. And subsection B requires that once the work has been done, an evaluation must be completed with respect to the contract and a report prepared on the contract. And that report and evaluation are to be maintained on file by the commissioner in the department administration or DOT for as long as the commissioner is required to maintain copies of completed contracts. And generally that would be a period of at least 7 years, since that is the applicable statute of limitations. But 6 years is the statute of limitations, but they're retained for an additional year, sort of as a pad.
Fat file.
At the top of page 10, we have a section which calls for filing, and this is the section that I described earlier that is a little different than the section that deals with filing of contracts for the legislative agencies. And this calls for filing of the original request for proposal, the response for the request for proposals, which was the winning one, which was the one upon which an award was made, and also the calls for the filing of the names of those others who proposed but were not the successful proposers. It does not call for the filing of the unsuccessful proposals. And that is the difference between this section that deals with filing and that of the that deals with filing in the legislative agencies after contracts are awarded. Section 070 on page 10, line 9, authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to adopt regulations under the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, to establish the manner and form by which these contracts shall be prepared and processed, and also requires that he establish a review process for persons who are aggrieved under this chapter. There was an attempt. We tried in House State Affairs to come up with procedures in the bill itself that would set out review for people who did not get a particular award, and ultimately it was concluded that a sounder way of dealing with it was just to require the commissioner establish those procedures and leave it up to the commissioner to work out exactly how those procedures would work. Then at the bottom of page 10, line 14, we have the definition section, and this is where the first definition says the commissioner means either commissioner of administration or, with respect to DOT contracts, the commissioner of DOT. We then have a definition of professional services, which is the same as that which is set out for professional services under the legislative contracting portion of the bill. At the bottom of the page, in line 26, there is a definition of what public necessity means for the exception that is authorized under the bill, so that there are standards to be met in the commissioner of administration making the determination that there is a public necessity, which requires immediate award of the bill of a particular contract. There's a definition of what a request for proposal is, and there's a definition, this is the top of page 11 now, on line 5, of state agency, and that definition of state agency is the one that includes the University of Alaska at this time. And that really rounds out the provisions of the bill which deal with professional services contracting for executive agencies. The next few sections of the bill deal with the state contracting under competitive bid procedures. Section 6 on page 11 would raise the present limitation or the present threshold after which competitive bids must be sought for goods, equipment, and those kinds of items from $2,500 to $5,000. The $2,500 limitation was adopted by the legislature in 1975 and has not been amended since that date, and as a result of inflation, has, in terms of real dollars, for those who are economists and talk in real dollar terms, that $2,500 limitation has actually effectively decreased. Each year, less can be bought under that limitation than the year before because the ceiling has not gone up since 1975. So there's the proposal here in Section 6 on page 11 to increase that bidding threshold from $2,500 to $5,000. The additional language on line 18 is on line 18 on page 11, where the words are inserted, the department may limit the solicitation of bids or negotiate directly if it finds that it is in the best interest of the state, is really to give the department administration more discretion in determining those situations where, in the interest of the state, less than full competitive bidding is going to be required. Right now, the only thing the department administration can do if it decides that full competitive bidding is not appropriate is authorize negotiation with an individual supplier of a particular piece of equipment. And this would authorize the department administration not only to authorize individual negotiations, which it can do right now, but also to authorize less than full-scale competitive bidding on a more than simply one supplier negotiation basis. So this, in terms of advancing the state's interest in seeking the best bid, this really, that language removes a restriction on the department administration's ability to go out and seek the best price once there's a determination made that full competitive bidding for one reason or another is not appropriate. Section 7. At the bottom on line 21, page 11, again, raises that threshold limitation from $2,500 to $5,000, and also with respect to small purchases, which that section authorizes the department administration to purchase directly on the open market and by cash payment, raises that limitation from $300 to $500. Again, that's a limitation that was established back in 1975 and has not been changed since that date. Now turning to page 12, section 8 at line 9 really is an amendment to the competitive bidding statute that makes it clear that professional services contracts must comply with the provisions of AS 2423 or 3698, and those are the two chapters which this bill would adopt, 2423 being legislative contracting, 3698 being executive agency contracting. Section 9 on page 12, which begins on line 12, is designed to clarify some difficulties which have arisen over the last few years in implementing the competitive bidding procedures set out in 3705-230. And basically the additional language does, well, it does this. It gives a definition of what a responsible bidder is. In the past, the statute has talked about making an award to the lowest responsible bidder, but it has then not given any guidance as to how you determine who a responsible bidder is. What factors do you look to? So this language from line 16 through line 25 sets out the kinds of considerations that department administration is to take into account in determining whether a bidder is in fact a responsible bidder.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dankert.
In that regard, we had four conditions named. And, one says performance record, so everybody will know where I'm talking about, starting on line about, number one is on line 18, page 12. One is adherence to the bid specifications, proposed terms of delivery, compliance with state laws, performance record. And of course, five is what we just discussed over there a moment ago on solicitation for bids. What always concerned me in these, because I know it's happened in a number of cases, when you talk about being responsible, financially responsible is important. Is that covered in here? So many people will bid on these projects and then they'll sit there and just ruin it. And it happened to me in one of my things that I was interested in doing, but there was no way the person could perform, but they just threw in a bid. But isn't there some way that there could be, by bonding there should be something in there to show, get to what you're talking about here, that they would have to show, that they're responsible and capable of performing.
I understand what you're offering, Senator. In one aspect, to the extent that they have adhered to the bid specifications, typically the bid specifications will say whether or not a bond is required in a particular, under particular purchasing that's to be done. There would be some situations where it would be appropriate, others where it would, where a bond, for instance, would not be appropriate. So to a large extent, that would be resolved by the specifications stated by the agency.
Senator Sackett?
I agree with Senator Dankworth, and I don't think the wording there gives enough direction. So I would add a new 5 and then make the present 5 6 and put you one word in financial capability or?
Well, yeah, I'm not real good at it, but does everybody know what I want to do? I think we ought to make that person, I cannot, if I go out there and bid on a bridge that I don't even own a construction company on, or maybe that's a little bit too far out, I think these others might cover that. But I just could not perform. They ought to put up a performance bond or something. And I don't know. I don't have any problem. I hate to have people put up bonds because some of your smaller companies have to bond perhaps unnecessarily. But
Senator Sackett sounds like has a good idea. If that's something they have to take a look at, their financial capability. In some cases, it may take a
that
bond, some it may not.
Yeah, financial capability.
Then it would say the department shall determine the responsibility of the bidder based upon the bidder's blah, 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 and financial capability.
Yeah. Or disfinancing could be the one word. Something that.
It should cover financial capability.
Yeah, all right.
Financial capability.
Financial capability?
Mm-hmm. Why and where?
It would be on line 19, page 12. Put new 5 financial capability, then 6 compliance with conditions, mm-hmm. etc. You could almost call it number 6. There was a lot.
I've made a note of the Senator's suggestion. I think it's a good one. On line, beginning at the end of line 20 and then continuing for the at that sentence, the purchasing agent may cancel the solicitation for bids before the award if it is in the state's best interest. This language is to make it clear that if it's in the state's best interest, for whatever the reason, the purchasing agent always has the authority to cancel an award, whether there's a particular problem with a bid or whether or not, or perhaps let's say the agency has just decided to change its mind after the bids have been offered. Right now, the way the statute is set up, it's at least not clear, and it has been interpreted, the language of the statute right now has been interpreted to say that there are only certain specific reasons under which the purchasing agent may withdraw a bid, so that the state's best interest, if it doesn't fall within one of those particular reasons right now, may require that a bid go ahead in any case. So this is designed to clarify that ultimately, if it's in the state's best interest not to make an award for whatever the reason is, the award can be pulled.
Senator Decker.
And I don't know whether it fits in this section. Another concern of mine has always been on bidding with those large numbers is some of the private industry go out and they have to spend a great deal of money putting together a bid. It costs money to put, particularly on a big project, and you can have $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 involved real quick in just preparing and getting the data to put in for the Connect Crossing or whatever it happens to be. And then suddenly the state decides that they, at the last minute, or some agent has the authority, he just says that purchases, they may cancel the solicitation if it's in the interest of the state. Does he have to show in any more concern than that, or just make the statement he doesn't, the state no longer has any interest in the project? Or is there any way we could, I guess I'm thinking that you might have in mind that we could protect the bidder in that last minute cancellation, or do you see that as a problem? You ask the guy to solicit, and he spends the money, and he gets it in there, and then all of a sudden some agent says, we've decided not to go out on bid on that.
I see it as a problem, but from the bidder's point of view, well, from the legal point of view of what a bidder is doing, he's always taking a chance that his bid won't be accepted. It might be superseded by someone else. I don't think there's a lot of reason to assume that, that bids are going to be yanked on a regular basis if this language is there. But certainly if you've got three competing proposers, they're always taking the chance, even if they sink $50,000 or $100,000 into making a proposal, that theirs would not be the accepted one. So it becomes a little difficult to identify those situations where, because the state has decided not to go ahead with giving the contract to anyone, why everyone should then be compensated for their costs. Yes. That's the counter problem, Senator, in any case.
I was just told that there has been some cases like that where they'll go in and then at the last minute, like the OT would cancel a bid and then they will put it out to bid a little bit later and a different group will bid on it. And that may be well and good, and I don't know, maybe there's a good reason for not doing it. Somewhere down the line, I guess I try to protect that businessman out here, because most of them don't want to do good business with the state anyway because of this type of thing. But when they do go to the trouble and hire the staff and consultants and put together a good professional bid, and then just have it turned down because some agent says, we've decided to cancel the bid, we're going to come up sometime later and do something. I know of people that really have been hurt, and I don't know whether the state should have some responsibility, say within 90 days or after the 10 or 20 or 30 days after you put out the proposal, if you have not canceled or reconsidered by that time, I think the guy that's putting in a responsible bid has a right to some claim for his cost, maybe. Here, I don't know whether we can solve that in this bill, but these are the things that are, we're handling the state's concerns, but I'm talking about the guy out there, the little businessman that tries to work with the state and bid with them. These are some of his problems, and they're more than just every once in a while.
Chairman, just one more, I think that's an important one. I don't quite know how to solve it. I think getting this thing in statute is going to be one of the biggest things, and they can't go around just doing the fact they've got rules and guidelines. I don't know whether there's a solution there or not.
I was wondering if there's some kind of language that you can put in, we'll see, within X number of days before the award of a bid, whether that would be, again, problem of the legal constraint of the state's best interest being able to cancel at any time.
You still run into a situation where there may be a bona fide reason for canceling after that number of days has gone by. So what you might want to do is set up a two-tier step approach. Within so many days, no financial implication for the state. If it's canceled after so many days before the opening, let's say, then they're taught with some sort of a mechanism to compensate for some element of
the cost. Yeah, perhaps, Mr. Chairman, if I could suggest it, even if he had some priority if the bid was reopened. In other words, his money wouldn't be lost. What I was concerned about, they go out and they do the bid and then they cancel it, and then the first thing you know, you almost have the same project out again and someone else is bidding in a whole new group and one or two little specifications that have eliminated someone else can now bid. But somehow could preserve himself in some priority in the next bid, but assure that he would be in there. Perhaps.